Good evening, everybody. Let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation. And let's come back to that basic essential Dharma truth, which is that our happiness and our suffering comes from our own mind. It doesn't come from anybody else or anything else. Comes from our own interpretations, our own attitudes and emotions, our own actions. And so seeing that, let's really take advantage of this lifetime to look inside and make use of our talents and abilities to purify our mind, to create the cause of happiness for ourselves and others, and especially to progress along the path to full enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. From last week that I'll just deal with before going into this. It's quite similar to what we talked about last week, but it was, if there is no inherent existence of self, then do the karmic seeds produced in any given lifetime actually have any inherent existence? No, nothing has inherent existence. Okay? Because inherent existence means something exists independent of all other things. So independent of causes and condition, independent of parts, independent of a base of designation, independent of terms and concepts. So the self doesn't exist independent that way. And karma and the karmic seeds also don't exist independently in that way. Okay. Because if any of them were inherently existent, they could not be produced because they wouldn't depend on causes. Okay? Okay. If they don't, in other words, if they don't inherently exist, then how do they keep a continuity in order to go on after death and become manifest through a new rebirth? It's precisely because they don't have inherent existence that they are able to go on into the next rebirth. Because if they had their own essence, if they existed independently of other things, then they would be permanent. They could not be affected by any causes and conditions. If the self were permanent, it couldn't change. It couldn't go on to the next life. It would be fixated. Okay? If karmic seeds were permanent, first of all, they couldn't have been created. And second of all, they couldn't bear any results. Yeah, so it's precisely because things lack inherent existence that they're able to function. It's precisely because they're dependent, because they're unfindable under analysis, that they do function on the level of appearances. So initially it seems very contradictory, you know. We want them to function on the level of appearances, and we also want them to have their own independent essence. But if you think about it, something can't do both. You got to choose. Yeah, either it's inherent and independent and doesn't change, doesn't function, or it changes and functions, is impermanent, and therefore is dependent. Okay? Got it? Okay. So we will continue on from where we left off last time. And we're at the part that talks now about the need to determine selflessness. In other words, why is it important to realize selflessness? Okay, so again, I'll read a little bit from the book and then stop and do other, you know, summarize some parts. The way to eliminate ignorance completely is as follows. We have to eliminate it by familiarizing ourselves with the absence, established through reasoning, of the apprehended object in relation to whatever object the self-grasping focuses on. So what that means is that to eliminate ignorance, we have to see that the apprehended object of ignorance, the object that ignorance believes is there, that it apprehends, does not exist. Okay? The great being Dharmakirti has said in his commentary on Dinaga's Compendium of Valid Cognition, without discarding this object, one is unable to eliminate it. So you actually have to identify the object of negation and then realize that it doesn't exist. And in that way, eliminate the mind that grasps at it. That object has never existed, so we don't actually eliminate the object. We're eliminating the mind that grasps at it. Then there's a very interesting section here. Instead of doing that, if one... we merely familiarize ourselves with collecting and establishing our thoughts. Or two, we acquaint ourselves with a non-conceptual state in which thoughts about whether things are existent or non-existent, whether they are or are not, no longer arise. Or three, if in meditation, following analysis of the general appearance of what is negated, our analytical understanding differs from the meaning intended, or we meditate merely on a non-conceptual state in which we do not recognize emptiness. However long we prolong the meditation, we will never be able to rid ourselves of the seed of the misconception of self. That was all one sentence. Okay. So it says, with regard to the first. So the first one was merely familiarizing ourselves with collecting and stabilizing our thoughts. So what this is referring to is that even if we have attained one of the jhanas or one of the formless realm absorptions, we can keep the mind completely in that state. Okay, so the mind's very stable and it's very focused. Okay, so even though the mind is not involved with the self to be negated at that time, in other words, since, you know, somebody's in samadhi, they're not actively grasping at a truly existent this or that, okay, it's still that mind doesn't apprehend the opposite of the way the misconception of self apprehends. Okay? Because remember, we want to perceive the opposite of what ignorance apprehends. Ignorance is apprehending inherent existence. We want to perceive the lack of inherent existence. So you might have samadhi on whatever object, you know, it could be the image of the Buddha, it could be a color, it could be any number of different things, even love. You know, all these are objects to gain samadhi on, or to gain the jhanas, the form and formless realm concentrations. But even if you've attained that, you know, you're focusing on one object single-pointedly, but the object you're focused on isn't the opposite of what ignorance apprehends. So you're not focused on emptiness. So even though the mind's stable and it's peaceful and it's not involved in grasping a true existence at that time, it hasn't eliminated the true existence because it's not perceiving the emptiness of true existence. Yeah, you with me? Okay. So, and here he says, again, the commentary on Dinaga's Compendium of Valid Cognition also states, since love and so forth do not directly counter ignorance, they cannot eliminate that grave fault. Okay? So we, you know, may meditate on many things on the method side of the path, you know, love, compassion, the image of the Buddha, you know, we may practice generosity and develop samadhi and all those kinds of things, but they alone do not have the power to eliminate ignorance because none of those minds, as virtuous as they are perceiving the opposite of what ignorance is apprehending. Okay? Then, the second mistaken approach, which is focusing on a non-conceptual state, in which you're not thinking about are things existent or non-existent, things like that. Okay, so some kind of just non-conceptual state. Yeah. So the second mistaken approach is to confuse any and all the objects of any kind of conceptuality apprehending existence, non-existence, and so forth, with the object apprehended by the conception of true existence. In other words, you're confusing all conceptions with the conception of true existence. Okay? And thinking that if the mind has any conception at all, it's grasping a true existence, that its object is true existence. Okay? So even though the true existence is the object to be negated when we're meditating on selflessness, yeah, it doesn't mean that every conceptual mind is grasping at true existence. Every conceptual mind may have the appearance of true existence, but it doesn't grasp at true existence. So the antidote to grasping at true existence is not just having a non-conceptual mind. Okay. So this is the big difficulty when we talk about the debate in Samye at the end of the 8th century with Hoshang Mahayan, who came, you know, one Chinese abbot who came, who was advocating blank-minded meditation, because he said, clouds are white, clouds are black, they're still clouds and they obscure the sky. So whether you have a virtuous thought or a non-virtuous thought, still none of them are realizing the true nature. So just get rid of all conception whatsoever and abide in a state of non-conceptuality. That's what he was advocating. But the problem with the state of non-conceptuality is that, like the first thing of just having the jhana samadhi, is that you aren't realizing the absence of true existence. You aren't perceiving the opposite of what ignorance is apprehending. You're just perceiving blank-mindedness. Okay? So that kind of blank-minded meditation does not get rid of ignorance. Are you understanding? This is quite important, because somebody could have a total non-conceptual state, not be thinking about anything. It's very peaceful. There's no grasping in that mind. And they may think this is liberation, but in actual fact, again, they aren't negating inherent existence. They're just having a blank mind. And so it's actually a misconception to think that all conceptions are bad and wrong. Okay. Now, while it's true that eventually in our progress of understanding emptiness, we want to get to the point where we see emptiness non-conceptually, you know, you've got to do that to have the direct realization and to enter the path of seeing. But to get to that point, we first have to have a conceptual understanding of emptiness. Okay? We've got to realize emptiness inferentially. And to do that, we have to understand the teachings on emptiness. And when we're hearing teachings on emptiness, we're using our conceptual mind. Okay? Whenever we're using language, there's concept involved, isn't it? Because language is just, you know, expressing a certain idea about something. So there's many beneficial conceptions. You know, when we start out at the beginning of the path, if we were to think, well, all conception is bad, so you just sit there, then would we even know what the path is? Would we know what to practice and not to practice? We wouldn't know anything. Yeah, so just the process of listening to teachings involves conception, and the process of hearing, you know, and thinking about the teachings is teaching us how to think about things correctly. Because you might notice that in a lot of our life, the teachings are really trying to help us think correctly. You know, like when we get mad at somebody, we have all our reasons why we're mad at them. And what the practice of fortitude is getting us to do is to develop different conceptions about the person we're mad at and different conceptions about the situation because we're thinking in a very unreasonable way. Okay? And so similarly, to learn emptiness, you know, it's not just getting rid of all conceptions. It's being able to identify what is the thing that doesn't exist that we think exists. You know, so we have to hear teachings, get an idea of what that is. Think about it. You know, what is inherent existence? Why can't it exist? You know, and so to understand why it can't exist, we're using conceptual minds. Okay? We're learning how to think clearly. And then, of course, once you understand that conceptually, then, you know, you can start meditating on it deeper and deeper and get a non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Okay, but we can't go there just right away. So it's not a question of erasing all thoughts from our mind. Because cows don't think very much, do they? Yeah. I always joke, maybe that's why they call them holy cow, you know? So if you know, not thinking very much and being a holy cow were the sign of gaining realizations, then cows would be out of samsara. Yeah? Is that true? I don't think so. Unless you have a Buddha who's appearing in the form of a cow. But aside from that, you know, okay? And then the third mistaken approach, which was you do a little bit of analysis and then you focus your mind on something that you think is emptiness, but it isn't. In other words, your analysis hasn't been spot on, okay? So the third mistaken approach is to establish something other than the view of selflessness through analytical awareness so that when we meditate, our meditation is misplaced. So you do some analysis, you think you understand what the emptiness of true existence is, but you haven't really, and you focus on what you think that emptiness is. Okay? So since it is unrelated to the right view, it is like being shown the racetrack, yet running in the opposite direction. Yeah? So we're thinking, oh, this is, you know, emptiness, and this is the meditation on emptiness, but we're meditating on our own idea of some sort. So you can see this also is a big danger, isn't it? Yeah? If you haven't received teachings, if you don't think deeply enough about the teachings, very, you know, easy to get confused and either negate too much or not negate enough. Okay. Moreover, since the clinging onto any specific objective basis is the basis for what is apprehended, we must discern the factor that counteracts the manner in which we apprehend it. So again, this is saying that we have to realize the opposite of what emptiness, what ignorance is apprehending. Okay. To do otherwise is like trying to catch a thief but avoiding following his tracks. You're not going in the right direction. You know, you're going where you want to go, but you're not tracking the thief. Or it's like offering a torma to a spirit who's gone in the west, but you offer the torma to the east. Okay? So the Tibetans offer tormas, you know, you appease a spirit or something, so you've got to do it in the right direction. Okay? Or put it this way, it's like going to pay your taxes, but you go to the hospital instead. Okay? It's not going to work. So, yeah. So these are three kind of pitfalls to look out for. You know, getting stuck in single-pointed concentration. Yeah, getting stuck in a non-conceptual state and getting stuck in meditating on what is not emptiness but thinking it is. Okay, so I think it's very helpful to be aware of these mistakes to make sure we don't fall in them. Yeah, so these kind of warnings kind of come, you know, fairly often in the teachings. Okay, Now we're going to talk about the way to determine the view of selflessness. So this includes the order for establishing the two selflessnesses and the actual techniques for establishing the view of selflessness. Okay, so the order for establishing the two selflessnesses. Okay, so remember we talked before that according to the Prasangika, there's no difference in subtlety between the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena because you're negating true or inherent existence on both of those. Okay? But they usually say the selflessness of persons is easier to recognize because, you know, most people can see, once they have some kind of explanation, that the self is something that is imputed. Yeah? In the sense that in order to recognize a person, in order to identify a person, we have to have some connection with their body, speech, or mind. We don't identify a person without coming into contact with their body, speech, or mind in some way. Okay, so it's on the basis of somebody's body or their voice, or I guess if you're telepathic, you read their mind, that then you label person and you can identify a person. So all the schools recognize that a person is imputed in this way. In other words, that you don't perceive the person directly, you have to perceive something else, and on that basis you say the person is present. Okay? So all the philosophical schools agree on that. And in our mind, when we think about it, yeah, that's true. So we can get some idea of how the person is imputed. On the other hand, when we see, you know, the green color of the cloth here, it doesn't seem like the green is imputed in any way. The green is appearing directly to our eye consciousness. Okay? So somehow the green appears to us, it seems to us to be more real, yeah, than the person does. So you can see why, you know, in the Vaibhasika system, when they talk about what is an ultimate reality, they go down to, you know, the particles of earth, water, fire, air. They go down to the basic colors, the basic tastes, and so on. Because all of those are things that can't be reducible by further analysis. When they appear, you know, they appear directly. Of course, the smallest atoms can't appear directly. We always need a combination of them. Okay, but we can see that why those things seem much more, you know, real to us. The person, we need to perceive something else before we know the person's there. Okay, so for that reason, they say meditating on the selflessness of persons is easier than meditating on the selflessness of phenomena, and therefore we do that first. Also, because it's easier to we have so much familiarity with the feeling of I, okay, and with the wrong conception of I, that it's easier to bring that to mind, isn't it? You know, all the time we're thinking I. And also because that, you know, the reason we start out with the selflessness of persons is because that's the one that really is the troublemaker, because we're always referencing everything to this inherently existent self that we think is there. So it's a huge troublemaker. Grasping that the green of the tablecloth is truly existent doesn't get me into nearly as much trouble as grasping it myself is truly existent. Okay? Can you see that? Yeah, because all of our the attachment, the aversion, the jealousy, the resentment, all of these come from grasping ourselves as truly existent. Yeah, they're really rooted in that. Not all of them come from grasping the tablecloth or the cup or the telephone or something else, you know, or even our body or, you know, or some other phenomena as truly existent. So, you know, that's another reason we start with the self, because it's such, that grasping is such a big problem for us. Okay. So it is like this. In order for a person such as Devadatta to appear as an object to our minds, we have to depend on apprehending his aggregates so his imputed existence can be established. So that's what I was saying. To, you know, apprehend, you know, Joe, we have to apprehend some aspect of his aggregates to know that he's there. Okay? And these things appear to our mind more easily in terms of the self, the grasping at the self. Then there's a quote from the Condensed Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Just as you understand selflessness in yourself, understand it similarly in all sentient beings. Just as you understand selflessness in all sentient beings, understand it similarly in all phenomena. Okay? So, understanding selflessness in yourself is going against the view of a personal self. When you do that, then it's an easy next step to see the emptiness of all sentient beings. And then from there you go on to see the emptiness of the aggregates, the body and mind and all other things that are the mine, the belongings of the sentient beings. Okay? So the actual techniques for establishing the view of selflessness has three aspects. How to determine the selflessness of persons, how to determine the selflessness of phenomena, and how in dependence on this, persons and phenomena appear like illusions. So the first two is how to realize the selfless persons and selfless phenomena. That's what you're doing in your meditative equipoise. And then the last one is how to see persons and phenomena as appearing like illusions. And that's what you practice in what's called the subsequent attainment. In other words, when you come out of your meditative equipoise on emptiness. Okay, you with me? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, so now how to determine the selflessness of persons. Okay, to begin with, this concerns recognition of what the basis, the person, is. Okay, now here we get into some interesting things. What is the person? So you might remember that we had a little chart before. Remember our chart? So this chart is explaining what, according to the different schools, you know, the person is, what they think it is. So the non-Buddhist schools say that there is a permanent, partless, independent self, soul, Atman, something that's independent. That is the person. Okay. Then you have the Vaibhasikas who say that the five aggregates are the person. Or some of them say that the consciousness aggregate is the person. Or some of them say the person is inexpressible as either one or separate from the aggregates. That one covers all the bases. It's not one. It's not separate. It's inexpressible. Okay. Then we have different types of satantrikas. Some are scriptural proponents. They say the continuum of the aggregates. Okay, so the continuum of the mind or the continuum of the body, you know, that is the person. Some of those satantrikas that are reasoning proponents say the mental consciousness is the person. You know, so all of these, they're saying it. In other words, when you look to find out what the person is, there's something really there. The Chittamajans that are scriptural proponents say there's a foundation consciousness. The Chittamajans that are reasoning proponents say it's the mental consciousness. Yeah, the Yogacharya Svatantrika Madhyamaka say there's a continuum of the mental consciousness. The Svatantrika Madhyamakas say there's a settled neutral mental consciousness. So all of them are saying that somewhere within the aggregates, you can identify something that's the person. Until you get to the Prasangikas, and they say the person is the mere I. What is the mere I? It's what is merely labeled independence upon the aggregates. So it's not something findable. Okay. So all of these schools assert that the person is imputed to the mental and physical aggregates. In the way that I was saying before, that you have to perceive one of the aggregates to perceive the person. So all of the schools, the systems, even the lower systems, say the person is imputed. But what they mean by imputed is not the same thing that the Prasangikas mean by imputed. Okay? Yeah, so whenever you hear the word imputed, you have to see what the context is. It means different things in different contexts. Okay? For all the other schools, when they say the person is imputed, it is eliminating being able to see the person directly without perceiving any of the aggregates. That's what's being eliminated. Okay? When the Prasangikas say the person is imputed, what they're eliminating is the person existing from its own side. Okay? So, you know, imputed is meaning different things in different situations. So don't get confused when you hear, oh, well, the lower schools say that the person's imputed. Well, the Prasangikas do too, so why do we have to spend so much time refuting the lower systems? Well, because the meaning when they say imputed is different, because they think even though the person's imputed, there's still something there that is the person that you can identify upon analysis. Okay. Whereas the Prasangikas say, no, when you analyze using ultimate analysis, there's nothing whatsoever you can pinpoint. Yeah? Nothing. Okay? Okay, every person, whether a man or woman, an exalted or ordinary individual within cyclic existence or liberated from it, is designated independence upon the aggregates which form the basis of designation. So this is the Prasangika view. Okay? In this regard, neither the continuity of the assembly of aggregates, okay, so it's not the continuity of the collection of aggregates, that's the person, nor just the collection of the aggregates, nor individual aggregates, okay, nor the continuity itself, nor even the one to whom that all those aggregates belong, none of those are the person. Okay. Now, so again, we can't pinpoint something, one of the aggregates, combination of the aggregates, the continuity of one aggregate, the continuity of the collection of aggregates. You know, you can't pinpoint anything and say that is the person. Mm-hmm. Okay, so none of its individual parts, not the collection of the parts, is the chariot. So this is if we take the example of a chariot. Yeah, it is designated independence upon the various parts, such as the wheel. But the wheel is not the chariot, the collection of parts isn't the chariot. Okay. And so there's one sutra quotation, which was said by a Bhikshuni. Just as we speak of a chariot, or we'll say a cart, okay, dependent on the collection of parts, so we speak of a sentient being conventionally independent on its aggregates. Okay? So what this is meaning is we start out with the example of a car, let's say. You know, chariots were really highly prized in ancient times. Now, you know, whether you have a chariot or not, I don't think people care very much. But whether you have a car or not is a big deal. Okay? And so, you know, what we call car, when we look, we see the car. It looks like there's a real car there, you know. There's the car. It's real. It's shiny. It's red. It's blue. It's silver. Whatever it is, you know. And then especially when you add my car, then it's really juicy, you know. My car. So, really solid. But when you investigate, you know, what exactly is the car, and you look in all the parts, the steering wheel and the axle and the spark plugs and the seats and the engine and the wheels, and what else do you have in cars? The gas tank and the, yeah. So you look at all those parts individually, and none of them is a car, is it? None of them. Yeah. And the collection of the parts, we may think, oh, you put all the parts together, then you have a car. But not necessarily, because if you just threw all the parts together, you would just have a heap of stuff. You wouldn't have a car. Okay. Then you think, oh, it's the arrangement of the parts that make the car. It's the shape, you know, and the arrangement of the whole thing together. That's the car. But, you know, also, that's just the arrangement. It's just the collection put in a certain way. And none of, again, none of the shapes of the individual things are a car. So how can putting all of them together be a car? Okay. None of the way the different parts are arranged in and of themselves to become a part is a car. So how can you put a bunch of non-cars together to get a car? I think that's a very nice way to say it, you know. Whatever we look at, it's composed of things that are not it. Yeah, it's a very easy way to put it. When we look at the gong is composed of things that are not a gong. And we look at the clock, and the clock is composed of things that are not a clock. And the same with the cup. It's composed of things that are not a cup. But it's interesting, when we look, you know, just deal with something offhandedly, it looks like, you know, there's a gong there, and there's a clock, and there's a cup, and there's me. But when you just scratch the surface and analyze, anything we see is made of things that are not it. So if none of the parts are the object, how could the collection of the parts or the arrangement of the parts be the object? You know, if we have here a bunch of things that are not an apple, how can we put them together and get an apple? Yeah, that's what we're asking. If you have a bunch of things that are not that, how does putting them together get you that thing? And that's when you see that to get that object, the mind has to conceive and impute and label that in order to get the object. So in the same way, when we say me, when you look at what the person is, yeah, what I am is all non-me things. Okay? What I am made of, is all not me things. Yeah? Because we say, okay, here's children. Yeah. The body is not children. Children's a person. The body is form aggregate. Okay? The consciousness isn't a person. Yeah? It belongs in the consciousness, you know. When we're dividing impermanent things, it goes into consciousness. The mental factors, my moods, all the different mental factors, those also go under, you know, mind in the thing. So everything we look at that we use to say, here I am, is not me. Okay. So it's kind of easier to see that in relationship to a car. The car is made of non-car things, because a wheel isn't a car, a wheel's a wheel. And an axle isn't a car, it's an axle. And the engine isn't a car, it's an engine. So here are all these non-car things put together in a certain shape. How in the world do you get a car if none of the things there are a car? They're all non-cars. So that's kind of, we can get that with the car. But when it comes to us, it's harder, isn't it? It feels like, well, wait, there's got to be me in one of those things. One of those things. It isn't just this impersonal body and an impersonal consciousness and impersonal mental factors. It's not that my anger is impersonal or my love is impersonal. You know, we identify with these things so strongly. This is me, you know. But if you really look, all of our different moods, all of our different consciousnesses, they are impersonal states of mind, aren't they? None of them is a person. Yeah? Our visual consciousness, it's an impersonal state of mind. Yeah? Our love, our anger, our faith, all these are impersonal. It's kind of jarring to say that, isn't it? Because it feels like, no, they're not impersonal. They are me. And there's a person in there that's me. There's really a me. There's really a person. I'm sure of it. But when you dissect all these things, you can't find any of them that is a person. And any of them that in any way is personal whatsoever. You know? Because we think, oh, well, it's my personal body. What? Who owns this body? Who's the my? Who's the mine that we think owns this body? Or it's my temper. It's my happy feeling. It's my compassion. All of those are totally impersonal. There's no concrete person in them, and there's no concrete person that they belong to. It's jarring, isn't it? It's very jarring. Because we feel like, but wait a minute. Okay, you put all these things together and it's labeled me, but there's something more in there. There's really a person in there. There's really a me. There's some unique being there. Okay, I'm merely labeled, but I'm really a unique being. Because can't you see my body's unique, and my mind's unique, and my moods are unique, and my thoughts are unique? What's unique about your thoughts? Do we think that we've ever thought anything that nobody has ever thought before? It's pretty arrogant, isn't it? Yes, my thoughts are unique. Nobody's felt the way I felt before. We have this kind of feeling, you know, there's just this uniqueness, yeah? There's a real person that makes it quite special, yeah? Okay, it's kind of like the car example, but you don't really understand. It's not exactly the car example, because there's really me. But it is the car example, because you look at every single one of those things, and none of them is a person, and none of them is personal. They're impersonal aggregates. Okay. So such a technique for determining the selflessness of the person is one of the best methods for cognizing the reality of things quickly. Okay. So we start out with the example of the car, then we go to the person. Then after that, it's quite easy to come back to the car again. Okay, so the same reasoning should be applied to all phenomena from form up to the omniscient mind. In order to determine in such a way that there is no inherently existent person, we establish that there is no inherently existent I, and then that there is no inherently existent mind. Okay, firstly, when we generate the view of selflessness in our mental continuums due to the faultless logical reasoning of being free from being inherently one or many, the conceived object, yeah, the apprehended object, is not observed. And through the reasoning of dependent arising, the opposite of true existence is observed. Having examined our own continuums to begin with, the vital point is to recognize how the innate misconception of a self of persons conceives its objects. This has already been explained. So remember, we talked for a while before about, you know, if inherent existence existed, what would it be like? Okay? So it's something that is unrelated to everything else, something that stands on itself, stands by itself. Okay? Something that we don't identify as being one of the aggregates, but it's kind of mixed in with the aggregates. That's what the object of negation is. Yeah. So something that stands on itself, by itself, without depending on anything else. That's what we're looking for. Okay. So of the two meditative techniques, analytical and stabilizing analysis, then it's going to talk about those. Okay. So whenever we do meditation on emptiness, we start out with analytical meditation. And then when we get some feeling for what we're analyzing, then we hold that firmly in our mind in what's called formal or stabilizing meditation. Okay. So the whole idea is that whenever we see that the opposite of the apprehended object of ignorance, then it's negating the apprehended object of ignorance. Okay? So it's kind of like when you see things are partless, you negate their parts. When you see that they have parts, you negate that they're partless. So when you see something as empty of true existence, you're negating true existence. So we'd want to see that emptiness of true existence in order, that's the only way to negate true existence. Okay, saying that there's no elephant in the room doesn't exist the presence of the bell. Okay, we have to see there's no bell in the room to negate the presence of the bell. Okay, so now we're get into the whole meditation on are things, it's often presented, are they one or are they many? Sometimes, are they singular? Are they plural? Are they one and the same? Are they separate and distinct? So all of these things, these different ways of translating it, revolve around the same principle, but they may take slightly different slants sometimes, but they come around to the same thing. So before we go on to this section, let's see if there's any questions so far. Yeah.
It seems that single pointed concentration, jhanic samadhi, is non-conceptual.
Is non-conceptual. Okay, so it seems like single-pointed concentration, jhana, is non-conceptual. There can be some that are non-conceptual and some that are conceptual. For example, if you use the visualized image of the Buddha, that's a conceptual image in your mind. If you're meditating on your breath, then after a while you get this little small sign called a nimitta, some kind of color or sparkling light. So that's an appearance to the mind. I don't know if they say if that's conceptual or non-conceptual. I'm not sure. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't understand this whole thing about the meditation going awry by doing non-conceptual meditation, because non-conceptual meditation isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Okay. So why is non-conceptual? Why does your meditation on emptiness go awry just by being non-conceptual? Isn't not being just non-conceptual? Why is being just non-conceptual a bad thing? Just being non-conceptual isn't a bad thing. Our sense consciousnesses are non-conceptual. Okay? And so you can attain, you can have a non-conceptual state of jhana. And that's nice and it's relaxing. And you can stay in it for a long time, but it's not going to lead you to liberation. So that's what those three points we're getting at, is that those three things, either staying in a state of jhana or having a state of non-conceptuality or meditating on something you think is emptiness but isn't, you might have samadhi with all of those things, but none of those things are going to lead you to eliminate the ignorance. None of those things alone are going to lead you to eliminate ignorance. So if you have the right view of emptiness, okay, and then so you're first cognizing emptiness via a conceptual appearance, and then through constant meditation you're able to wear away of the veil of that conceptual appearance of emptiness, then you perceive emptiness directly, and that perceiving of emptiness directly is what is going to counteract the ignorance. Okay? But just non-conceptually alone, without it being non-conceptual, realizing emptiness is not going to eliminate the ignorance.
Yeah, it just seems that usually when we talk about non-conceptual things or non-conceptual meditation, it's usually talked about in a very critical way. Like, as usually saying, like, well, if you want to do non-conceptual meditation, just go be reborn in the animal realm. Or you know, it's like equating with being stupid or being dull-witted or something.
Uh-huh.
Or I think they even say that sometimes it doesn't result in doing that meditation, it's becoming dull-witted.
Uh-huh.
But then that gives non-conceptual meditation alone, or non-conceptuality, this sort of this feeling of like it's a bad thing.
Okay, yeah, so it's true that often the way we talk about non-conceptual meditation, it sounds like it's a bad thing, but here, when we're just saying non-conceptual meditation, it's meaning just being non-conceptual alone, not non-conceptuality focused on emptiness. Okay? Also, the word conception and non-conceptuality, it can mean so many different things in different circumstances. Sometimes non-conceptuality just means not having manifest hindrances, not being distracted, not having distracted thoughts. So you might still be focused on a conceptual image of something, but you know, they say it's non-conceptual because you don't have distracting thoughts. So, you know, what is considered non-conceptuality? It depends on the circumstance. What is considered conceptual depends on the circumstance. Okay. When we're talking about, the non-conceptual realization of emptiness, it means realizing emptiness without a conceptual appearance. You know, this dunshi, or meaning generality. Yeah, is other times when they're saying non-conceptuality, it just means blank-minded, nothing. Okay, and so here what it's emphasizing is blank-mindedness is not the same thing as the emptiness of inherent existence.
So when you say blank-mindedness, are you not trying to eliminate an object? Trying to not have an object
okay.
in mind?
Yeah, blank-mindedness. There's no objects in your mind. There's nothing in your mind. Well, it's interesting because some people say, you know, there's no object, and then some people say actually to be considered a mind, it has to have an object. So maybe its object is nothingness. I don't know. Some debate about that. Yeah.
So, well, it seems that when you're looking at the mistakes, the three at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
I would say that all of my meditation on emptiness is doing a little bit of analysis and focusing on the wrong thing and pretending that it's empty.
Okay.
To some extent. So it's like that's a training.
Okay. Okay, so you're saying that, you know, your meditation on emptiness sounds like the third one. It's doing some analysis and then focusing on whatever you think emptiness is. So that's fine. That is the training way. That's the only way to get a correct understanding of emptiness. But the thing is, you know that you haven't realized emptiness. Whereas in this third fault, the person hasn't analyzed, they think they've realized emptiness, they stay in that state for a long time, but actually it's not, and they don't know it's not. That's the problem. Okay? But for the rest of us, some, you know, you analyze and you get some feeling of it's not there. And yeah, that's good.
Question online. When trying the meditation on the nature of mind, clarity and awareness, is this a blank mind?
Okay. Yeah. So when you meditate on the conventional nature of the mind, it's being clarity and awareness. Is that blank-mindedness, or can it lead to blank-mindedness? If you do it properly, it's not blank-mindedness, because your object is the conventional nature of the mind. But you have to be very acute in your meditation, because it's very easy for you start out having, you know, meditating on the clarity and awareness, conventional nature, but then you slip into nothingness without knowing that you've done that. So they caution when you're developing samadhi, when you're developing shamatha, based on the conventional nature of the mind, they really caution about not letting the mind slip into nothingness. But meditation on the conventional nature of the mind is part of the conventional Mahamudra practice, and, you know, it's a perfectly valid way to meditate, you know, and can be very, very helpful. But identifying what is the clarity and aware nature of the mind, that's hard. That's not so easy. You had something?
You said that we wear away the veil of the conceptual by repetition.
Mm-hmm.
So we're at repetition of this analytical meditation.
Okay.
And then it seems so strange that you can somehow, I don't know, go from conceptual to non-conceptual. How
yeah.
How can that happen? I understand why they said let's just be non-conceptual.
Yeah.
Although it doesn't work, I get that.
Uh-huh.
But I understand why,
because
it's almost impossible to.
Yeah. Yeah. It does seem strange, doesn't it, that you can have a conceptual realization of emptiness and go from that to the non-conceptual? And what does it mean to wear away the veil of the conceptual appearance? You know, they say that you do the analysis, and of course when we start out, our analysis is very, very gross, isn't it? We're using words and thoughts and images, and it's very, very gross. But then more as you go into it, then you're not thinking in words so much, yeah? But the analysis gets more subtle, and it's more investigating, and it's not, you know, whenever we say analysis, it doesn't mean a lot of intellectual chatter in the mind. Okay? So it's more like, sometimes they use for rikshe, this mind probing awareness, you know? So it's a mind that's probing, an awareness that's probing the nature of reality. Yeah, so it isn't like you're always thinking, you know, is my body the one with my I? Am I my mind? You know, you're not always thinking those things, but it's a more subtle investigating thing. And so you get to a point where there's, you know, you're perceiving emptiness. You have the right view, but you're not perceiving it directly. There's still some kind of veil there. So that veil is called a conceptual appearance. So the mind is called conceptual. But I think when you're that subtle, it's not like our very gross concepts now, you know? Okay.
It's a nice image that you know, wearing away the veil.
Yeah.
Suggests the possibility.
Right. And you can see there's going to be a difference. It's kind of like if you touch something and you're wearing a woolen mitten, you know, versus touching it wearing a garden glove, versus touching it wearing, you know, a silk glove, versus touching it with your bare hand. You're wearing away, and so how you relate to the thing you're touching is changing as the, you know, what's between you and the object gets more and more subtle. Mm-hmm.
You were teaching this part about all these parts of ourselves that are impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
So my mind there goes to just kind of this feeling, what's the point, like having friends? What's the point of relating to people?
Uh-huh. Okay.
So why does that happen?
Yeah, so when we're talking about things being impersonal, then the mind just goes, well, what's the point of having friends? What's the point of, you know, relating to people if all of them are impersonal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Exactly. It does feel like you're dropping into a nihilistic thing. So you can see how when we're grasping tightly at truly existence, when we start to dismantle it, our mind goes, well, if it doesn't truly exist, it doesn't exist at all. So if this person is not a real person with their real, unique feelings, personal something, something that is different than their body and mind, if they're not that, then you're telling me they're just a flat pancake, like a cardboard person there. You know, like the cardboard. You know, like when we were kids, the little cardboard people. Remember, we used to have them, and then you used to dress them in the little flaps you fold over and try on different clothes.
Paper dolls.
Oh yeah, paper dolls. So you know, so okay, so they're either real people or they're paper dolls.
We've not added in all this stuff. We're talking about, you know, what are you adding in that? Really,
yeah.
So what's left of this mirror eye?
Yeah. Well, you know, the mirror eye is just what's labeled. You know, it exists by being labeled. There's nothing there you can point to. We say mirror eye, but we still want to point to something that is a unique, personal, individual, special.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just true existence again. Yeah, not the body, not the mind, not this, not this. But there's something still in there.
Well, there is a person.
Yeah, there is a person. But it's a person that you can't find when you search for it. Yeah. It sounds really weird. Yeah. But then if you think, could there be something in there that really is a person, that's independent of everything else, then that seems very difficult to posit also. Because if there is something that's independent of everything else, then, you know, the person can't arise and cease, and it can't change. Yeah? So you see that, you know, the mind, there's got to be something. Otherwise, it's nihilistic, there's no person there. But if there were something, well, that one doesn't make sense either. So you get stuck in this weird place. And it's all because we think if it doesn't inherently exist, it's non-existent. We're not, you know, our mind isn't seeing the middle way. That it's neither of those two extremes.
It's obvious that when you have a troublemaker that when you do this, it's quite helpful.
Uh-huh.
You
kind of
analysis,
it's
the gap. Yeah. But it's funny that it just pulled all around.
Yeah. So it is helpful when you have a very strong emotion and you analyze, oh, there's no me. Okay, I can relax. You know. But then when you're just, you know, kind of going through the day, what do you mean there's no me? I'm here. You know, or when you have attachment, then we don't like negating it at all. Only when we have pain, then do we like emptiness. But when we have pleasure, we don't like emptiness.
You don't want to give up this I exist.
Yeah.
So you just get unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah. We cling for all our might.
So my other question was quicker.
Okay, we're going to have to stop. Yeah, go on.
This grasping at myself is truly existent, that's the troublemaker. That's the one that stems the psychic existence.
Yeah, the mind that grasps at our own self as truly existent, that's the one that's the first link of dependent arising that spins, mm-hmm. that causes cyclic existence.
Okay.
Okay. So we have to stop now. We'll continue next week.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kandiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Warren.